Good morning, everyone. The members will please come to order. We're short of quorum, but...
The hour of 10 o'clock has begun. Welcome to visitors and the audience to the Labor and Consumer Protection Division of the Commerce Committee here in the Minnesota House. We've got two presentations up first this morning and then followed with a bill hearing on House File 532. We would like to start with presentations from our from two of the House research staff who work on issues related to this committee. Mr. Pender and Ms. Newman, if you'd come forward. Thank you for taking the time with us this morning.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Anita Newman from House Research. And if you'll notice, Mr. Pender came up with one sheet of paper. Ms. Newman had to come up with a whole folder because based on my 6 weeks of experience with this, if you ask me anything hard, I've got to look it up. I'm going to provide you with a very brief overview of the jurisdictional breakout of labor law between the federal and the state, talk a little bit about the minimum wage activity, and then look to some other issues. And we do have a handout, double-sided. One side is the employment issues, and the other are the issues that Mr. Pender will cover. And that should be in your packet. The jurisdiction on employment-related laws is split between the federal and state government. The federal law covers collective bargaining and labor organization, and generally preempts state law, except in very limited cases. The law that we work under dates back to 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act was created, and then it was subsequently amended by the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947. This set of laws covers virtually all private sector employees with some very limited exceptions. Government employees are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act, nor are railroad or airline employees, agricultural employees, and domestic employees. Minnesota has subsequently adopted the Minnesota Labor Relations Act to deal with employees that are not covered by the federal law. We also have the Public Employee Labor Relations Act that covers public sector employees. Wages and working conditions are covered under federal law by the Fair Labor Standards Act. In Minnesota, they're also addressed in the Minnesota Labor Relations and the PELRA laws. Workplace safety issues, there is a federal law, OSHA, which establishes some minimum standards. That law allows states to enact their own occupational safety and health laws, which Minnesota has done. Minnesota has its own OSHA law, and you've heard a brief presentation about that from Labor and Industry, so I'm not going to speak to that in any detail. Discrimination issues related to employment are covered in a variety of places. The U.S. Civil Rights Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, Family and Medical Leave Act, which guarantees employees the right to come back to their job after taking leaves for certain circumstances. Minnesota also has a Family Leave Act, which is slightly different from the federal law. It also covers 16 hours of school-related leave for the children of covered employees. And Minnesota has the Human Rights Act, which has some slightly different protected classes in terms of employment protections. Probably the premier issue related to labor right now, as is in the papers and on the radio and television, is the changes in the federal minimum wage. Both the U.S. House and the Senate have approved minimum wage bills to take the minimum wage up to $7.25 an hour It stages it in three steps over the next 26 months. The House law differs from the Senate law in that, the Senate bill includes a little over $8 billion in various tax breaks over a 10-year period. That'll have to be worked out in conference committee. Several other states have been working on minimum wage laws as well, and according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 29 other states, plus I believe it's Puerto Rico, it's the District of Columbia, currently have minimum wages higher than the federal minimum wage. Some other employment issues that the Minnesota legislature has dealt with before and will certainly come before all of you again are the family leave, which I talked a little bit about before. Just last year, there was a minimum wage proposal in both the House and the Senate here, a livable wage proposal, rather, that would have established a livable wage at $14 an hour and have imposed a surtax on employers who did not meet that standard. There are prevailing wage laws on the books in Minnesota already. There's been legislation to deal with outsourcing of Minnesota jobs. Unemployment insurance and what's referred to as FUTA dumping have been issues. Minnesota adopted a federal model law, I believe, in 2005 to regulate the avoidance of unemployment taxes by some entities in Minnesota. And then workers' compensation continues to be an ongoing issue. We have in Minnesota a Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. It has 12 members. It was created in 1992. One of the members of this division is a member of that advisory council. And it's my understanding that there is an informal agreement that laws containing any major changes to workers' compensation go through that advisory council where there are representatives of labor and employer organizations on that. So, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'm going to stop there and take any really easy questions you might have.
All right. Representative Howes, do you have a softball for Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chairman, not immediately. It turned into a softball. But,
okay.
Ms. Newman, you brought up the fact that Minnesota has its own OSHA department.
Yes, we do.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Newman, I would like, if the chair is okay, that you send to the committee any rulings that OSHA has made in the workplace regarding secondhand smoke. I would like to see if they've considered a hazard, and if so, how they rank it with other things, and also then probably give us the federal results or restrictions or what they have on smoking. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chairman, that if OSHA comes before this committee, that possibly I think the smoking ban should come before this committee.
I'll take that under consideration, Representative Howes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Newman, do you have
a response? I have nothing to add to that at this point, but I will certainly check that out for you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Newman? Mr. Pender, thank you.
I'm Tom Pender from the House Research Department. I'm going to be talking about the area of consumer protection. That's the other side of the two-sided sheet that is in your packets and that Ms. Newman has been using. Actually, Ms. Newman and I are going to be sharing the area of consumer protection. I'm going to be doing the insurance and financial transactions kinds of things, and she's going to be doing most of the others, but I'm going to give the entire presentation because she did the labor. She did the labor part. I'm going to just, when I started preparing for this, I thought about whether I should try to come up with a definition of consumer protection. And that's kind of a touchy subject, and I wasn't sure I wanted to take a crack at it, but I decided to do it. And so here's my definition at the top of the page. Consumer protection is a law that prohibits or otherwise regulates a transaction between a consumer and a business that the state decides would not be entered into by an informed and rational consumer. And I'm hoping that's sort of a neutral definition of the term. And obviously people differ on any specific transaction, whether it is one that a rational and informed consumer would enter into, and also on just the underlying issue of how much the state should regulate private market activity. I have here in the next part of the outlines some areas and examples of consumer protection, and I'm just going to cover these very briefly. It's mostly for new members to get a kind of get a sense of what kinds of things the legislature deals with. And I want to spend most of my time on the part of the outline at the bottom of the page there on the nuts and bolts of consumer protection legislation. Looking at the areas and examples, I'll just go through them quickly in order there. Insurance is a very common subject of legislative attention, and it's a highly regulated industry. There are lots of chapters of Minnesota law that regulate all the nooks and crannies of the insurance industry. The Department of Commerce regulates insurance. Financial transactions, there are always a lot of bills dealing with that subject in the legislature, and I just give a few examples there. Mortgage lending, and I should have probably added foreclosure, credit cards, gift cards, payday loans. In dealing with financial legislation, one thing that always comes up is that federal law preempts the states from regulating virtually anything involving nationally chartered banks or federal credit unions. So that's always an issue in dealing with financial legislation. We can regulate our own state banks and our own state credit unions. That creates a playing field kind of issue, and those state chartered institutions can switch to a federal one if it becomes a disadvantage to be regulated by the state. So it's always an issue that comes up, and there are businesses that engage in a lot of these financial transactions that aren't banks or credit unions or others. So anyway, that's always an issue that needs to be looked at. Privacy and identity theft prevention, we've had quite a bit of legislation on that in recent years. I list three examples there that have been done in recent years, and as we've already seen this session, there are more issues still to be dealt with. Generally in this committee, we don't deal with the criminal side of preventing identity theft. We deal with the civil side, which is mostly regulation of businesses to try to force or encourage them to take actions to make it harder for people to engage in preventing identity theft by the way they handle personal information. Another example is the homeowner warranty law. We have a statutory warranty in our law setting out specific warranties for new homes and substantial remodeling projects, and these are warranties that are in every transaction of that type, regardless of whether they're mentioned in any of the paperwork that passes between the builder and the homeowner. These are warranties that are simply automatically there because the state law says they are. We have a lemon law for automobiles. That's something that constituents frequently ask members questions about, telling a sad story and asking whether the state lemon law might cover their situation with a car they bought. We have a variety of consumer product safety laws, and then there's just a whole great variety of miscellaneous consumer protection laws. And if you're the kind of person that likes to read Minnesota statutes as bedtime reading, you could browse through especially the chapters that start with 325, like 325E, 325F. There's just an incredible variety of consumer protection laws in there. It's just astounding. And a lot of them get passed and you never hear about them again. We don't know if they're working well or if they are not having any impact at all, so they're just a great variety of them. Some of them I look at and I just know I've never seen them before, never had any need to look at them. I want to move on now to talk about the nuts and bolts of consumer protection legislation. And this is sort of oriented toward a member who's has an idea about consumer protection and is working on putting together a bill to deal with it. But I think what I'm going to say is equally applicable to another member that's evaluating that bill later and deciding whether they want to vote for it or not, or a member who's opposing the bill and can maybe use some of these ideas to oppose the bill. I'll also say I think the things I'm going to talk about here are often afterthoughts when the member is putting together the bill. It's not the main focus of what the member is thinking about, which is usually what do I want to prevent from happening. But these kind of things often can affect whether the bill ultimately passes or whether it will turn out to be effective at all in actually preventing whatever activity the member wants to prevent. One thing that needs to always be considered is federal preemption. There are quite a few laws that limit what we can do in various areas of consumer protection, and it's good to look at that issue up front to see whether the idea you're thinking about has any possibility of going anywhere or not. Sometimes it's hard to figure out whether federal law preempts it. One way to deal with that, at least initially, is just put something in your bill to say that this law doesn't apply to the extent that it's preempted by federal law. At least then nobody can accuse you of trying to do something that is preempted by federal law. Another thing to look at is what kind of protection you want to provide to the consumer. It could be a prohibition where you prohibit a business from doing a certain thing or prohibiting a business from selling a product without having a certain sentence in the contract or something like that. You can also require a disclosure to consumers where you're not prohibiting something, but you're just saying that if you are doing this, you have to disclose it to the consumer. And sometimes we have state laws that are very specific on this that have a required text of what the disclosure has to say, and often it specifies how large the type has to be and whether it has to be in bold or not and whether it has to be in a separate sheet of paper and all that kind of thing. And often sometimes the required disclosure is kind of an industry fallback kind of position. If they can't keep a law from getting passed, maybe they'll agree to not oppose the law, but lets them keep doing what they've been doing, but just disclose it to consumers. So sometimes that's not the way a bill starts out, but might be the way it ends up. Another thing that consumer protection bills could do is could involve consumer education. Some state agencies put out pamphlets, for instance, consumer-oriented pamphlets to help people become better informed. Or one area of this kind of thing that we might see this session is in the area of mortgage foreclosure, educating people that are in that situation about what their options are and how to proceed. One important thing that you have to decide in dealing with a bill like this is what kind of penalty should there be for violating this law. And often when a member calls me and asks me to draft a bill on consumer protection, at some point in the conversation I say, well, what do you want to happen to somebody that violates this law? And there's often sort of a long silence, because it isn't something that the member has thought about and been thinking about, what they want to prevent and not what should happen to people. And sometimes it's kind of hard to figure out what you think should happen to someone who violates a consumer protection law. And there are a number of possibilities. One is to make it a crime. And in fact, if you say nothing in your bill about what happens to people who violate the law, then it is automatically a criminal misdemeanor, because we have a statute, a general statute, that says if there's anything prohibited by Minnesota statutes and no penalty is specified, it's a criminal misdemeanor. So that's sort of a default provision. And I think in making something a crime, you have to be kind of realistic and think about our busy criminal prosecutors and busy law enforcement officers going to be wanting to spend a lot of time enforcing this law that requires a certain kind of warranty when you sell a car or something like that. It's usually not the kind of thing that criminal prosecutors and law enforcement officers thought they'd be doing when they went into that profession or the reason they did it. So it's often not a high priority as compared to solving murders and things like that. Another option is to use administrative penalties. And this is often done when you're regulating something where you've got a business that's already regulated by some state agency. And then there's often a framework already set up for enforcing laws that affect that business, and you can just put it in that agency's chapter, and that agency's enforcement proceedings then will just normally generally apply, and the the agency can suspend or revoke a license. They can do an administrative fine. They can order the business to stop doing this or whatever. And that kind of makes it easy often. Generally, agencies, it doesn't usually work too well to have a state agency enforce something where they don't otherwise regulate that business, because they just don't have as much leverage and as much enforcement ability over a business that, you know, they don't even know who's in that business or, you know, very much about it. And so often that's not, and the agency often isn't enthusiastic about taking on something like that where they're just regulating a little piece of what some business does, and it's not, you know, not something they have any expertise in. Another option is to give a private right to sue, where you just say that if you're a consumer and it's harmed by this, you can sue. And sometimes that's helpful because you don't have to provide any public money to enforce the law. Sometimes you need to give the consumer an incentive to sue. So if a consumer suffers damages of $50 because a business did something that violated the law, they don't have much of an incentive to sue for that $50, but if you put something in the law saying that you get some automatic amount of general damages plus your regular damages, then you've got a little incentive. So if you say, well, if the consumer sues for violation of this law and wins, they get automatically $2,000 plus their actual damages, which might be $50. And maybe you need to put in something about attorney fees, where maybe they can, if they use an attorney, they can get reimbursed for at least some limited amount of attorney fees, and sometimes it helps to put a limit in on that. Helps to make it more acceptable to put in a limit of whatever, $1,000 or $2,000 or something for attorney fees. So that can be an option for enforcement. Then the issue comes up, who should enforce it? And sometimes that follows from the thing we just talked about what the penalty should be. If you're having a state agency do it, then they're going to be the enforcer. Sometimes the Attorney General is the choice for enforcing consumer protection legislation. That's a fair percentage of our consumer protection laws are enforced that way, especially against businesses that aren't otherwise regulated by a state agency. The Attorney General's office has a statute, 8.31, which gives them broad choices of enforcement authority. And so if a consumer protection bill simply says this is enforced under 8.31, that's one way of dealing with it. One thing to think about is whether you're going to get a fiscal note on your bill, whether a state agency is going to put in a fiscal note saying this is going to cost us something. And that, once that happens, makes it harder for the bill to pass. The bill will go to a finance division. It'll probably be in that division's omnibus bill. You kind of lose control of it. And so it's good to try to think about that up front, whether you can structure the bill in a way that there's going to be no fiscal note from any state agency. Another thing to look at up front is the cost to the businesses of complying with your bill, because that's going to be the main source of opposition to the bill often. So if you can figure out a way to reduce the cost of complying in one way or another, maybe make it similar to laws they are already subject to in other states, so they don't have to, you know, have different procedures and different forms, or you know, just think about that issue of trying to reduce the cost so as to reduce the opposition. So I'm going to stop there, and if people have short questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Pender. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Consumer protection also would protect people who went to a restaurant, so that would be a second reason to bring the smoking ban here. And, Mr. Pender, I do have a question for you. I haven't read the full bill with regard to the smoking ban, but I've been told, and I accept it as fact, that the penalty for not a restaurant, let's say a penalty if they allow somebody to smoke in a restaurant, is a civil penalty with a $25 fine. Now, if that were changed to a misdemeanor and a $25 fine, would that then encompass the reservations?
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Powers, I haven't read this year's version of the bill yet, so I'm a little limited in answering your question, and also that particular question. I'm just not able to answer that question right now. I just don't know the answer to that.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Pender. Could you find that information? I guess my question would be, tribal governments do not have to follow Minnesota civil law, is my understanding. But criminal law, they have to. So that would be my question. Is there a difference there?
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Hollis, I will get you the answer to that question, and I know that it's a complicated one. I know, for instance, there's been a Minnesota Supreme Court decision, for instance, saying that our mandatory auto insurance law is not enforceable on reservations, even though that is a criminal law. So I will get you an answer to that the best I can.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Pender or Ms. Newman? Thank you both very much for your time. Next on our agenda is the report by the Office of Legislative Auditor on prevailing wages. If they would please come to the table. While we're doing that, we do now have a quorum, and we need to approve the minutes from our past two meetings. Representative Szymanski, have you had a chance to thoroughly review the January 19th minutes?
Mr. Chairman, I have.
Excellent. Representative Szymanski moves approval of the January 19th, 2007 minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Dietrich, good morning. Have you had a chance to thoroughly review the January 26th minutes?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. No, I have not.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Scalzi, have you had the chance to review the January 26th minutes?
Yes, I have, and I found them very interesting, and I need their approval.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Representative House.
If there are some members that haven't read it, maybe we should have a roll call on the approval.
Along with the smoking ban.
Yes, I'll withdraw.
Thank you. Throws you off the stride of your tenacity today, Representative Hounds. Representative Scalzi moves approval of the January 26th minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Nobles, and the legislative auditor with me is John Yunker, who is the manager of our evaluation of prevailing wages. Also in the audience is Carrie Meyerhoff, who is a member of that evaluation team. We appreciate being with you this morning to discuss with you our evaluation of prevailing wages in Minnesota. As each of you know, every year the Office of the Legislative Auditor goes through a process of asking legislators what they want us to evaluate. What are your concerns about particular state government programs and activities? And when prevailing wages appeared on that list, I think there were some members who thought maybe that's not an appropriate evaluation for the Office of the Legislative Auditor because it is largely, in many people's minds, a political and philosophical debate. But we found, and I think the Legislative Audit Commission found when they approved this topic, that some aspects of the law can be evaluated and assessed and analyzed on an empirical basis. We won't be able to, on that basis, solve all of the political and philosophical issues that arise, but I think we can enlighten you on how the law is implemented and enforced in Minnesota. One of the things that I think you're going to learn is that even though the law does have many issues related to philosophy and politics, implementing it is actually quite complicated and even bureaucratic. You have to have a lot of data, and you have to do some statistical analysis, and then you have to enforce it. And those are the things that we looked at. And so Mr. Yunker is going to give you a brief presentation of what we found and what we recommend. And then after that, we'd be happy to answer your questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Mr. Yonkers, welcome to the committee. Members, my intent or preference, if it works with Mr. Yonkers, would be to hold questions until he's completed his presentation. Mr. Yonkers, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Yunker. I was the project manager for the study. I'm going to first try to provide a little background for you on the prevailing wage law, then talk about our conclusions in a little more detail, and in the process, talk about some of the recommendations in the report, particularly the ones that require some legislative action. Minnesota is one of 32 states that has a prevailing wage law. Federal government also has a prevailing wage law. Minnesota's law sets a floor on the wages and benefits that are paid to construction workers. And what this means is that on certain public projects, contractors must pay at least the prevailing wage rate, which is set by the Department of Labor and Industry. And just for future reference, the prevailing wage rate includes both wages and benefits. So even though it's referred to as the prevailing wage law or prevailing wage rate, benefits are included. The law applies to state-funded projects, but it can also apply to local government projects if they receive direct state funding. And it does apply to some private development projects, such as Job Z projects. Since 1973, the law has covered projects of $25,000 or more, but it can cover projects as low as $2,500 if only one type of worker is used on the project. The Department of Labor and Industry is responsible for setting prevailing wage rates, and they do that for 147 job classes. They do it for both commercial construction and for highway heavy construction. And for commercial construction, they do it in each of our 87 counties. For highway heavy construction, they do it in each of 10 regions. Overall, the department can set more than 4,600 different prevailing wage rates each year. Now, to do that, they first collect information annually in a wage and benefits survey, and they ask contractors and unions to supply them with information on what the wages and benefits were that were earned in commercial, on commercial and highway-heavy construction projects over the past year. And then they take the information from that survey and they set the prevailing wage rates according to state law. And state law says that they are to use the most frequently reported rate from that survey in setting the rates. And you'll often hear that referred to as using the mode to set prevailing wage rates. That's the technical statistical jargon. There are a number of issues that have surfaced about prevailing wage rates over the years, and we looked at all of these issues, and you'll see that we have some conclusions about some other issues as well that came up during the study. Perhaps the biggest issue is about the fiscal and economic impact of prevailing wage laws. Critics of these laws say that if you pay higher wages and fringe benefits to workers, then you increase the construction costs that the public pays. And supporters say, though, that there's little or no effect of prevailing wage laws on construction costs, because if you hire more highly skilled workers, more highly paid workers, you end up with more productive workers who don't necessarily cost you more in the long run, and they produce a better quality product. There's also been controversy about the survey that the department used to set prevailing wage rates. It's been criticized for producing information that's not representative of the wages and benefits that are paid in the construction industry, and it's been suggested that a different survey be used instead. The method that's used to set prevailing wage rates, the mode, has also been criticized as being unfair, and critics say that the method results in prevailing wage rates that are higher than the wages and benefits typically paid in the construction industry. And it's been suggested that Minnesota use the average or median meaning middle rate reported in the survey. There are six basic conclusions I want to talk about today. First of all, as Jim Nobles alluded to, there are basically no clear answers about the economic impact of prevailing wage laws. And maybe that's not surprising, because many of the studies that have been done have been funded by either supporters or critics of the law. There are some academic studies, but even in looking at those, I think we reached the conclusion that we can't reach any firm conclusions about the economic impact of prevailing wage laws. We do think that the department's annual wage and benefit survey should be retained, but we think that it needs improvement, and we recommend in the report that the department work on improving the survey's response rate. We also think that the evidence suggests that there are some prevailing wage rates that are not representative of wages paid in the construction industry. But in looking at that evidence, it suggests that, as far as we can tell, that's more the exception than the rule. We also discovered along the way, although we weren't intending to do this, we discovered that the department hasn't always followed some of its more technical administrative rules in setting prevailing wage rates. So there have been hundreds of prevailing wage rates that have not been set according to state rules. We also looked at the overtime pay requirements in state law, and we think that the current requirement in statutes is inflexible and outdated, and that it does require overtime pay on prevailing wage projects, sometimes even when union contracts do not require overtime pay. And finally, we find that with the exception of state-funded highway projects, there is an adequate enforcement of Minnesota's prevailing wage law. In fact, we think there is considerable confusion about who is responsible for doing the enforcement. As I mentioned, we were unable to reach any firm conclusions about the fiscal and economic impacts of prevailing wage laws. On the issue of construction costs, there have been many studies that have looked at this issue. Some have found that prevailing wage laws increase construction costs, while others have found that they don't. And there really is a mixed record, and we spent a lot of time in the report, in the last chapter of the report, looking at the economic impact of prevailing wage laws. But in the end, I think there is no firm conclusion that we can draw from these studies about the impact on overall construction costs. We also find in the report that there really is no evidence out there, very little evidence about how prevailing wage laws affect construction quality. And I think that's probably because it would be extremely difficult to conduct such a study and measure quality and try to compare the quality of projects that were done under a prevailing wage law and done without a prevailing wage law. As I mentioned, we think that the Department of Labor and Industry survey should be retained, but we have some serious reservations about that survey. We think that, in particular, that it has a low response rate. And I'd like to give you an illustration of that. For commercial prevailing wage rates, the department first tries to set a prevailing wage rate based on wage and benefit information from each county. So they look at the wage and benefit information in that county, and then if there isn't enough information, they go to information from adjacent counties, and if there isn't enough information from adjacent counties, they might use a last year's prevailing wage rate if there was one. Well, two-thirds of the time, they're unable to set prevailing wage rates based on information from the county they're trying to set rates for. There, two-thirds of the time, there was not, in 2005, two-thirds of the time, there was not even a single worker's wages and benefits reported to be used to set a prevailing wage rate. So they do not have a lot of information. They do not have enough information that they're getting out of that survey. And I think that raises questions about whether the survey is representative of the wages and benefits paid in the construction industry. We do reject the idea, however, that the Occupational Employment Statistics Survey, or OES survey, should be used instead. That survey does not seem to be particularly well-suited for prevailing wage rates. For setting prevailing wage rates, it includes wages for residential construction work, which tend to be much lower than those paid for commercial and highway heavy work, and it doesn't include fringe benefits. We also looked at the whole issue of using the mode to set prevailing wage rates, and we asked what I think critics ask, and that is, do prevailing wage rates reflect market rates? And I would first say that it's very difficult to answer that question because all you have to go by is the Department of Labor and Industry survey. You don't know what wages and benefits are that are paid in those segments of the construction industry. There's no other data source that's useful. But if you set that question aside for a minute and you focus only on the information they get from the survey and you ask, do the prevailing wage rates that are set using the survey data seem to be representative of the survey information, you conclude that most of the prevailing wage rates represent a majority of the reported wages. In fact, two-thirds of them do. And here's an example of that. For carpenters in Hubbard County, 42 responses were made to the 2005 survey, and a majority of them, or 57%, 24 of those responses came in at one rate, and in fact there were six other responses at a rate higher than that. So overall, 71% of the rates that were reported were at or above the rate that was used to set the prevailing wage rate. I'm not saying that this is always the pattern, exactly the pattern, but this is more typical of what you see with prevailing wage rates. It is true, however, that in a small percentage of the cases, prevailing wage rates do appear to be unrepresentative of reported wages. And here's an example of that. For common laborers in Monoman County, there were 15 workers' wages reported. Two of them were at $24.24, and that's where the prevailing wage rate was set. You might say, how is that the most frequently reported wage rate? Because there are actually five modes here in this data, five rates at which there were two workers reported, including $24.24. The department's administrative rules say that if there's a tie, if there's more than one mode, then you use the highest of the modes. So they use $24.24 to set the prevailing wage rate. But what you can see is that 13 of the 15 workers, or 87%, earned wages between $10 and $13.50 an hour, wages and benefits. And so in this particular case, the prevailing wage rate was not particularly representative of what workers were being paid for common labor work in Monoman County. Well, why does this happen? It happens because Minnesota, unlike most of the states that use the mode, does not require the mode to be a minimum percentage of the reported wages. There are 20 states plus the federal government that use the mode. Four states plus Minnesota use the mode exclusively, but the other 15 in the federal government only use the mode if it represents a minimum percentage of reported wages. So what that means is, for example, New Mexico and Wyoming say that the mode has to be 30% of the reported wages, or we're going to use some other mechanism. Maryland and Nevada say 40%. And most of the states in the federal government say 50 or more percent of the reported wages have to be at that one rate, or we're going to use, generally speaking, the average wage rate that was reported. As I mentioned before, we found some problems with how the department sets rates. And in particular, we found that with just the first problem mentioned on this slide, that there were more than 300 prevailing wage rates in 2005 that were potentially set incorrectly. And that represents about 8 to 9% of all the rates that they set. Basically, they have some problems with the computer program, and it doesn't follow the letter of the law in terms of following all of their administrative rules. And they've made some human errors, some errors in processing prevailing wage rates and setting them. And we think that they need to correct them. And some of the recommendations on this slide reflect that. I want to highlight, though, the first recommendation and talk about that just a little, because I think it's very important that the department improve the response rate so that prevailing wage rates are set based on a more representative set of wage and benefit data. The department is suggesting that they go out and conduct some outreach with contractors and subcontractors and educate them about the value of filling out the survey on an annual basis. And in fact, the governor's budget does include some money to hire some staff to enable them to do this. I want to talk about the overtime pay requirements a little bit. Since 1973, state law has set the prevailing hours of labor at 8 hours per day and 40 hours per week. What this means is that overtime pay at time and a half is required for work on prevailing wage projects whenever workers exceed this number of hours. We feel that the requirement is outdated and inflexible, and that it fails to recognize that in today's construction industry, some union contracts do not require overtime pay unless work exceeds 10 hours per day or 40 hours a week. So what this means is that state law is requiring overtime pay in some instances on prevailing wage projects, even when the union contracts don't call for it. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about enforcement, because this is a very significant finding in the report and an important issue. If you look at Chapter 177, you'll see that state law says that MnDOT is responsible for enforcing the prevailing wage law for state-funded highway projects. And it also says that labor and industry is responsible for all enforcement on all other projects. What this means is that labor and industry, even though they don't have construction contracts themselves, they're responsible for enforcing it on construction contracts that are let by the Department of Administration, MNSCU, the University of Minnesota, the Zoo, DNR, local governments, JobZ participants. This works well for state highway projects because MnDOT has control over those construction contracts, but it doesn't work well for other types of projects. MnDOT has a very comprehensive program for doing enforcement. I'll just mention some of the things that they do. They require contractors to submit certified payroll records to them during the construction phase. Certified payroll records detail out what each worker on a construction project is earning in wages and benefits and what job class they're in. And then they look at these records and they determine, they review them to see if the reported information complies with the prevailing wage requirements. And they go out and they do some site interviews of workers to see if what's being reported on the certified payroll records is consistent with what the workers are telling them. MnDOT is able to, if there are violations, to withhold payment from contractors if either the contractor or subcontractors are violating the law. And they've allocated resources for doing this kind of monitoring out in their regional offices, and they have a central office unit that investigates more complex cases. Problem is, though, with other kinds of projects. There's basically confusion about enforcement responsibility. The law says labor and industry is responsible, so the contracting agencies think that, well, we don't have to enforce the law. We're not responsible for it. Labor and industry is. Contracting agencies believe that the only thing, generally speaking, they're responsible for is making sure that the provision requiring the payment of prevailing wage rates is in the contract. But labor and industry says we don't have, and this has been going on for a long time. This is not a new problem. This is a long-standing problem. Labor and industry says they have little or no resources for enforcement, and they have no effective enforcement authority. They cannot withhold payment from the contractor. They are not the administrator of a construction contract. The contracting agency is. And if they even found a violation of the prevailing wage law, they would have difficulty getting it prosecuted because local prosecutors are not really interested in prosecuting misdemeanor violations of the prevailing wage law. They have a lot higher priorities on their agenda. We think that in order to resolve this issue, the legislature needs to change the statutes. The legislature needs to change the law that spells out who is responsible for enforcement. We recommend that you give contracting agencies the authority and responsibility to monitor and enforce the law. that you direct labor and industry to provide training and technical assistance to contracting agencies, and that labor and industry should also have an investigative capability to support the contracting agencies who are not, you know, the most knowledgeable about the prevailing wage law. We also think it would be a good idea if the legislature required contractors to submit certified payroll records, and that has two purposes. The first one is those records can be used, like MnDOT uses them, to monitor compliance with the law. And secondly, if a contractor submits a certified payroll record which is later found to be false, then the misdemeanor prevailing wage law offense can be converted to a felony, because it's a felony to provide false information to a public agency. We also suggest in the report that you consider enhanced penalties, perhaps a role for the Attorney General to prosecute cases if local prosecutors turn them down. And another option would be a private right to sue for workers who are not paid the proper wages. And finally, I think in order to make the system work, you need to consider providing additional funding, particularly for labor and industry, to fulfill this kind of training and technical assistance and investigatory role. And then think about how the contracting agencies can fulfill the role of doing enforcement as well. I think to some extent you can use, they could use capital appropriations to do enforcement, because they use those capital appropriations to hire architects, to hire owners representatives who oversee construction, and one of the duties of those folks could be to monitor compliance for the of the prevailing wage law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my remarks, and we'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee has.
Thank you, Mr. Juncker. Are there questions from members of the committee? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Juncker, can you give us an example of what you mean by the contracting agencies who you would like to give the authority to monitor and enforcement and the compliance? Just maybe some names.
Juncker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, that would be the Department of Administration, MnSKU, DNR, the Zoo. I mean, those are University of Minnesota. Those would be the entities, some of the entities that have responsibility for letting contracts.
Other questions from members? Mr. Juncker, in your suggestion about using capital funds to provide agencies with the funding to better enforce the prevailing wage laws, do you have any sense of a guideline as to percentage of a project that would need to be set aside for enforcement? Is there anything you can glean from the costs that MnDOT experiences in enforcing prevailing wage as a percentage of their projects, or a different guideline for funding the enforcement issue?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a particular guideline in mind, and I'm not sure if MnDOT does it in a way that you could come up with a percentage. MnDOT also has a lot of construction work, a lot more than some of these agencies would, so I'm not sure that they might have some efficiencies that other agencies might not have. I do think you've got to approach this in a reasonable way. You don't necessarily monitor every contract or every worker on every contract. You can do a spot check. You can check the contractors that you're unfamiliar with, that you haven't worked with, you think are more likely not to be paying a prevailing wage rate. You don't have to monitor this on each and every contract extensively. So I think this can be done with more of a risk management approach in mind.
And Mr. Chairman, I would just add, I think that the first step is the one we mentioned, and that is getting a certified payroll from the contractor as a requirement. And that in and of itself, I think, will serve as some deterrent. They are verifying, they're swearing that is a truthful representation of the wages they're paying. And as Mr. Juncker said, there would be some penalty attached to a false claim. So I think that would be a first step that wouldn't cost the state really anything.
Thank you. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question because of the slide related to Manoomin County. That particular slide, which showed the highest mode at $24.24, and yet there were obviously in the middle of that hourly rate scale, $11.25, $11.55, $11.75, and your statement was that if it's a tie, you use the highest mode. Where does that policy come from, please?
Mr. Yonker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swales, that policy comes from the Department of Labor and Industries administrative rules.
Is that the Minnesota Department? I'm sorry.
Mr. Yonker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swales, it is the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry and their administrative rules which say that if there's more than one mode, then they're going to use the mode that has the highest rate.
Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this based on then a federal guideline? Is this? I noticed in the next slide you talked about New Mexico and Wyoming must be 30%. I guess I was not following the logic here. Please forgive me. I'm an English teacher. I don't know.
Mr. Yonker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swales, this next slide I've got up here for you indicates there are 20 states and the federal government that use the mode. Mm-hmm. Five of them are somewhat similar to Minnesota, that they'll use the mode and that's it. But the federal government and 15 other states will only use the mode if it represents a minimum percentage of the reported wages. In the example we looked at, two of 15 reported wages were at $24.24. That's only 13%. Now, most of these states, I mean, all of these states require at least 30 or 40 or 50 or majority of the reported wages to be at the mode before they go to usually the average reported wage rate to calculate the prevailing wage rate. In this particular, if you apply that, even the 30% to that example for Manoomin County, you would calculate a much different rate.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cuthbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Yonkers, you mentioned, can you tell me what happens when there's not enough information to set a wage rate? You mentioned that often happens. What happened? What is the wage rate then?
Mr. Yonker?
It might help to look at some information, so I want to refer you to page 13 in the report. And just first looking at kind of the top half of that table, for commercial construction, there are, in 2005, there were 4,176 possible rates they could have set. 33% of them were set based on data from the county that they were trying to set the rate for. 29%, they had to go to another county, to adjacent counties, to try to set the rates. So if they can't do it based on data they receive from the contractors in that county, they go to adjacent counties. If they can't do that, they look at to see if there was a prevailing wage rate set in a previous year, and they used that, and they did that in 21% of the cases. And if none of those things work, they don't certify a prevailing wage rate, and that happened in 16% of the cases. So what I was referring to in the presentation basically was that only a third of the time are they able to use data from a county to set that county's prevailing wage rates.
Representative Gunther.
It just seems to me that it's totally foreign to the process that we're going through, but not having anybody report. What we got to do is absolutely find more companies to report their wages, and maybe even we could go to the extreme of coming up with the median salary, so we could at least back into that.
Mr. Yonker.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just elaborate on the point. I think so many of these issues come back to what was just said, and that is we need better data. We need more data. And that's why we put great emphasis on improving the survey by the Department of Labor and Industry. And as was mentioned, the governor has money in his proposed budget to improve that. Because if you are using the mode, frankly, if you're using any statistical measure of central tendency, it's all based on what data you have. And there are great limitations in this data. So, but as we said, we concluded that there isn't a better data source. But this one has so many limitations that it really needs to be improved. If I might just also pick up on a previous question before we lose that. The question was asked, what is the policy that results in using the highest mode? It's the department's rules. I just want to make sure members understand that that is still subject to legislative action. Administrative rules can be overridden by your actions in the legislature. So it is a matter of policy choice. The department has extended by its rulemaking authority the policies that you've made by having that as a protocol in the implementation of the prevailing wage law. But that is still subject to your policy making if you choose.
Thank you. Anything else, Representative Cutler?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
I know you, in the beginning of your presentation, you talked about the politics. There's some politics involved in this. But isn't there some benefit to the state to help maintain the wages up there instead of using the power of the state to drive wages down? Because if these people, if workers, make more money, they're going to be paying more taxes and being able to support themselves instead of driving into poverty, where then they may end up costing us on the backside with, you know, other type of programs that we have to support them with. And it's a political question, I know, and that's...
Mr. Yonker, is politics in your purview?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, generally not. So I'm going to leave that part of the of this to you. But there is, you know, I said that there's little that we can say about the fiscal and economic impact of prevailing wage laws. But there is some evidence that prevailing wage laws increase wages and benefits of construction workers. So just in regard to what you're saying, there is some evidence of that in the literature that's been written about prevailing wage laws. And we mentioned that in the final chapter of the report.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My response to Representative Nelson's question, and I certainly agree, higher wages do bring in more tax collection, but we're talking about higher wages on federally and state and county funded jobs. So we're talking about tax dollars paying for many of these jobs. So that kind of negates your statement, I think, a little bit.
Representative Nelson.
And that's kind of where I was going. It gets into the political, whether you determine whether the benefits to the state of having people making decent wages with benefits or being driven into lower wages without benefits, and the value of whether the value of paying more to get higher wage workers is offset by the additional cost of that, if there is an additional cost, and it doesn't seem to point that out in the study, or whether we want to use the state's dollars to drive people into poverty.
Any last questions for the auditors? Representative Lane.
On page 13, under the highway and heavy construction, it says that 34% rates were not certified. Does not certified mean, how do they pick the wages at that point, and is anything going to be addressed in that area?
Mr. Yonker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Blaine, if a rate is not certified and there's a project that comes up that needs a rate, then the Department of Labor and Industry is notified, and they will try to come up with some information, develop some information on the wages that are paid and set a prevailing wage rate. I think I didn't use highway heavy construction as an example for the following reason. You have the same set of occupations that are used in setting prevailing wage rates for commercial construction as you do for highway heavy. But some of those occupations that are used in commercial construction are not typically used in highway heavy construction. So you're not going to find a lot of those wages reported for highway heavy construction, and that's why I think you find that there are not a lot of, there are quite a few rates that aren't certified for highway heavy.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Mr. Chairman, might I just point out that there is a response from the department, from the Commissioner of Labor and Industry at the end of our report. I think we have general agreement with the department on our findings and recommendations. I don't know if you're going to hear from them, but if you're interested in their perspective on our evaluation, it is at the end of the report. Thank you
for pointing that out, and we will be hearing from the department at this time. Ms. Wade, if you'd come forward, please. We have two individuals, Ms. Wade from Department of Labor Industry and Mr. Raines from the Associated Building Contractors, who both wanted to respond briefly to the report. If there are others in the room who want to respond briefly, please let us know. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Wade, if you'd introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Rosalind Wade. I'm the director of the Labor Standards and Apprenticeship Unit. I'm here today to provide some feedback from the department's perspective regarding the legislative auditor's report on prevailing wage. As the auditors indicated, as indicated on the letter that's included in the report, the agency overall agrees with the auditor's assessment. This is the first detailed review of the prevailing wage program since the early 90s. Ironically, some of the findings and some of the findings noted were of noted concern as far back as 1992. I believe the report is an accurate reflection of the historical practices, the policy, and the available resources that have been dedicated to this program. I believe the findings are well on point. There is a significant need to educate the general public, the direct users, and even the legislature as to the impact of the state prevailing wage law. Based on this review, or during the process of this review, the agency worked very closely with the auditors as they made significant observations. We hurriedly made every change that we could, even while the program was still being reviewed. We were taking their recommendations and utilizing the current resources to make those no-cost and low-cost adjustments to the program. Because we were aware that this program was under intense scrutiny, as we prepared the agency budget as far back as June and July of 2006, we were posturing ourselves to make budgetary requests so that we could provide more resources. Many of the concerns that are indicated in the report, particularly the area that speaks to the absence of data, that results in wages set that are not an accurate reflection of the work that's being performed in the specific county, can be overcome by reaching out to the construction community, the real users of the system, by getting them more involved in the process, ensuring that they understand the impact, the results of what happened when you don't participate. Those, the results are pretty clear. If contractors, particularly from outstate area, do not participate in the survey, it sort of leaves labor and industry trying to defend the undefensible, because we can only certify rates based on the information that we receive. We don't have a blue book value of what particular classifications of labor, what those wage rates should be. We rely on an annual survey. We analyze the data, and we certify rates based on available information. I believe that many improvements can come to this process if more construction contractors simply participated in the survey. We are aware that prevailing wage as a subject matter is highly controversial. It's often more politicized because there isn't a clear understanding of what goes into the process, what happens after the information is received, what is the economic impact to the state and the users for participating or not participating. As I indicated, during the review, the agency was paused to make improvements where we could. However, in this entire program area, I oversee both the labor standards and the apprenticeship unit. Both of those units are greatly impacted by the prevailing wage program. With that in mind, in the labor standards unit, that unit is represented by a half-time director because my funding, my position, my responsibilities are to oversee both those programs. So the prevailing wage program itself, or the labor standards unit, is represented by a half-time director, 6 labor investigators, and 1 administrative support staff. When we analyze the resources that are dedicated to the overall administrative and enforcement responsibility of the labor standards unit, the actual resources that are dedicated for the prevailing wage portion is limited to 1.5 FTE. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that if you want a better product, you have to make some changes. If we continue to strain the minimal resources, then you cannot reasonably expect improvement.
Ms. Wade, if you could move towards your conclusion, just because of the committee time today.
All right. So, to wrap that up, I think that there is confusion, particularly in the area of enforcement. There was a time when the agency was a bit more active, but our process has not changed significantly. We believe, based on past input, that although the statute clearly indicates that labor and industry shall enforce on other than highway heavy, we lack clear investigatory and enforcement authority because we do not own those contracts. The commissioner's duty, as indicated in Chapter 177, gives the commissioner broad authority for records review, penalty provisions, clear investigatory authority, and it sets responsibilities for employers to comply with that. The commissioner's authority, it does not. The overall Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act does not include every provision, and it is not currently applied to the prevailing wage portion. We believe that if it's the legislative intent that labor and industry enforce prevailing wage, then there needs to be some statutory changes so that there is clarity as to the scope and depth of the commissioner's responsibility. We've operated on the premises that we have investigatory authority, but beyond the investigation, we are limited to turning our findings over to the contract owners. That leaves the contract owner, which are the state agencies, a bit confused. They're not the experts. They don't know prevailing wage law. They don't know the full impact. So we believe that if it is your intent that this portion of the law be enforced at the same rate as the remainder of the Fair Labor Standards Act, that the legislature have some responsibility here too, to clarify to labor and industry and to appropriate the necessary resources so that we can improve the program, improve the process, improve the response rates, so the rates that are certified are clearly representative of the wages that are paid in that area.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wade.
Thank you.
Members, we've got three individuals who wanted to respond. Mr. Raines, Mr. Nessie, and Mr. Melander, if I'm reading that correctly. We'll ask that those individuals keep their comments to no more than 1 to 2 minutes. Since we do not have legislation in front of us, if legislation is developed coming out of this report, they're always welcome back, and we can explore the issues more fully at that time. Representative Swales.
Just one, Mr. Chair, one quick request, and I appreciate Ms. Wade's comments very, very much, but I was wondering if we could have at least a bullet point summary of the things that she stated.
Ms. Wade, would it be possible to get a summary for committee members of your comments?
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Mr. Raines. We do have a bill hearing here for Representative Winkler's bill and wanting to get to that today in a timely fashion. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. I'm Bill Raines. I work for APC of Minnesota, the Associated Builders and Contractors. Since we have limited time, I'm just going to turn it over to our president, Bob Heiss.
Thank you very much.
Make comments.
Mr. Heiss, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Robert Heiss, president, Associated Builders and Contractors. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Quickly, since we only have a few minutes here, we want to congratulate the auditor's office. They're doing a fine job in focusing on administration and enforcement part of prevailing wage. I do think they skirted the debate on the cost and benefit analysis of prevailing wage here in Minnesota. Would you like some things about their report? Increase in response rate. We all want to increase the response rate. I represent about 400 contractors that employ 22,000 people around the state. I would call the people that work for these employers multi-skilled craft professionals. Sometimes it is hard for them to complete the survey because of job definitions and work rules really don't fit. So please take that in mind when you're looking at that survey, and I hope the department takes that in mind if they have the opportunity to redraft a new survey. Secondly, we do support the recommendation on hours. When you're in the construction industry, when you're building a road, if it rains, you may not have the opportunity to work on Monday, so you've got to get the work done Tuesday, Thursday, Wednesday, and Friday. Sometimes we have to work more than 8 hours in one day, but perhaps we can get the work done in 40 hours in one week. And then lastly, enforcement. My members don't break the law. We follow the law. We are in favor of enforcement. But let's be clear, the experts are within the Department of Labor. The Minnesota Zoo is a great place to visit animals. I don't know if it's the best place to see enforcement of complex prevailing wage rules. So let's beef up the Department of Labor. Let's give them the resources and tools they need, Mr. Chairman, to do their job. And here's the heart of the matter, and here's really what I want to get to. That calculation method, that modal calculation method, we believe it's not statistically valid. If you have 100 people in one county and only two people report 33.15, two people out of 100, that will be the prevailing wage rate for your particular county, $33.15. Something is simply wrong with that calculation. We'd like to look at a different calculation, and that would be the median calculation. Representative Gunther mentioned it earlier, and I think you have our little graphic of how this thing is done. If you have two people reporting the same wage, regardless of what the other people are reporting, those two people will set the rate. And it hasn't been mentioned earlier, and I'm not sure why. We'll ask the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Our understanding is that there's not the most commonly occurring rate, the highest wage will prevail in that particular county. We will investigate that further, but we're willing to compromise on this. Our solutions are on the back of this page, number 1, 2, and 3. Scratch 2, because some people don't believe the office occupational employment statistics is a good way to do it. Scratch 3, that would be D doing it, and they already do a survey, but some people don't think they should be doing it. Stick with number 1. Let's go to the median. And I know my friend Harry Molander is going to speak in a few minutes. Maybe we can sit down with Harry and members of your committee, Mr. Chair. And here's our compromised solution, and maybe it'll benefit everyone in the state of Minnesota, because this little activity gets a little expensive, more expensive than most states, I would say, because of our calculation method. Could we live with what the federal government does in 15 other states? That is, we'll go with the 50% rule. If we have 50% of the people reporting the same number in a particular county in the state of Minnesota, let's go with it. That's reasonable. But if we don't, let's go with the median or the average. Would be fair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Nessie. And again, a request the testifiers be brief. You're always welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Nessie, and I'm here today representing the employer members of the Quality Construction Coalition. The QCC is a labor management group. The employer members include about 12 associations that are comprised of well over 1,000 employers, so it's a large group of employers I'm here talking on behalf of today. Those employers support the current prevailing wage laws, and the reasons for that are several. I'll try to keep it brief. On the individual project level, we believe that the current prevailing wage laws protect local wages and encourage the employment of local employees and the hiring of local contractors. We also believe that the prevailing wage laws support the highest quality construction, which provides the highest value to the state. So if we're looking at things from a broad view, long term, we believe that you're getting a better value by using a contractor that pays prevailing wage rather than providing just a low price to begin with. On the social level, we also believe that the prevailing wage laws encourage proper safety training, skills training in general, and also those employers tend to pay better health and pension benefits than their counterparts that simply focus on the low price. Thank you to the Auditor's Office for an excellent job on the report. A couple of the recommendations from that report that we'd like to express our support for. Increased enforcement in general we think would be a good thing when it comes to the prevailing wage. Also increased participation in the survey, we think that would be a good thing as well. Allowing the Attorney General's Office to prosecute prevailing wage violations by employers when the local prosecutors can't or won't, we think that would be a helpful thing. And also a private right of action where an employee could file a private right of action against his employer for violating the prevailing wage laws. We believe that would be a good thing as well. And lastly, we believe that any additional enforcement authority that you can provide to the Department of Labor and Industry would be a good thing in addition to that. So, again, I said I'd try to keep it brief, so I have. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Nessie. Mr. Molander.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sir, Chairman, committee members, my name is Harry Molander. I'm the Executive Secretary of the St. Paul Building Trades Council. Apologize, Mr. Chairman. President Amfang from the State Building Trades was planning on being here today, but because of an unexpected emergency, was unable to attend. I will be brief. I just want to thank the Legislative Auditor for providing us with a quality product that addressed some of the issues that have been raised regarding prevailing wages. I will not give anecdotal opinions, as Mr. Hess did, regarding issues that probably should be taken outside of this room, but would like to mention a couple of things that were in the auditor's report. You know, we do support, as mentioned in the report, the issue of inclusiveness and individuals that would provide surveys. Tongue-in-cheek, we look at this as a non-denominational issue. We wish that everybody in the state of Minnesota that have an opportunity to provide surveys would do so. We also strongly believe that the method that's determined is one that's had a long history in the state of Minnesota and actually reflects wage rates for construction workers within the state of Minnesota. And also, and probably most importantly, is the supporting of additional help for the Department of Labor and Industry to ensure compliance of a process that definitely needs looking at and also needs enforcement. So with the wishes of the chair, my statements are brief and just appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you today.
Thank you, Mr. Moran. Representative Winkler, thank you for your patience. Members, we will take the time needed to hear House File 532. Mr. Winkler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your patience today.
Sure. Important issues you're dealing with, Mr. Chair. My name is Ryan Winkler. I represent District 44B. I urge your consideration, members, for House File 532, the Minnesota, get this term correct here, the Minnesota Service Members Supplemental Act.
Representative Winkler. Representative Benson, if you could please move to the vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a member of the committee, my name is John Benson. As a member of the committee, I move the approval of House File 532 and recommend its passage and also that it be sent on to the Commerce and Labor Committee.
Thank you. Members, with that, let's see, thank you. Representative Winkler, you have an amendment? Is that correct?
I do, Mr. Chair.
I believe the A1 amendment is in members' packets. Would you like to move that at this time, Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chairman, I move the amendment.
Let's just check. Is the amendment in members' packets? It is. Very good. All right. The amendment has been moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Winkler, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, this is a fairly straightforward bill. It has three components, and it deals with the issue of service members and sailors who are called to active duty, sent overseas, or who have had their base, camp, or fort transferred, been transferred to a new place. And it supplements a federal law, Federal Service Members or Soldiers and Sailors Civil Relief Act, which provides relief from from rent, mortgage interest rates, credit card interest rates, and other costs that service members incur when they are called to active duty overseas, and gives them the ability to find a way to more conveniently pay some of those costs. The Minnesota bill extends some of those protections to areas that are particularly important to younger members in service, especially in the National Guard in Minnesota, who have some of the different ongoing payment requirements than more established service members do. So, for example, rather than mortgage interest payments and rent, these members may take advantage of canceling without penalty cell phone service contracts, other kinds of service contracts like satellite television, internet access, that sort of thing. And it also includes a provision which allows them to essentially take advantage of the cold weather rule. And the essential purpose behind this legislation is that when soldiers and sailors are called by their country to risk their lives overseas or to serve in distant parts of the globe, they're not also asked to pay for a cell phone contract they can't use or to pay for wireless internet that they can't access or cable television that they can't watch. And it extends to a number of other areas as well, and I would urge your support. With me today is Brian Bergson, who is now a member of the Attorney General's staff and was a captain in the United States Army, just to give very brief comments on the value of this. And I'm also going to ask Colonel Eric Allness to come forward and talk very briefly about what the Minnesota National Guard currently provides for its soldiers as supplemental services for when they are called to active duty and sent overseas.
Excellent. Mr. Bergson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Bergson. I'm the Director of Communications and Legislative Affairs for Attorney General Lori Swanson. Quickly, when I was a brand new second lieutenant, I volunteered and was activated for Desert Storm. And at that time, I was living in the Riverwalk Apartments, which are in Minneapolis along the river just north of the post office. I went to my landlord and said, here are my orders, I'm leaving. I need to get out of my rental agreement. They wouldn't let me out. I didn't know what to do. I was a little bit taken aback. I thought, gosh, I'm going to have to pay my rent and be, you know, halfway across the country or across the world. And at that time, the Attorney General's office did not have a Veterans Assistance Office like we do now. We just implemented that within the last month. We have an office that's available for veterans. If they're having problems, they can call us, and we'll help them work through these. So I had to call the U.S. Attorney in the state of Minnesota. I was in the office, got told I couldn't get out of my agreement. I went back to my apartment, was wringing my hands, called the U.S. attorney. Within a half an hour, the landlord had told the maintenance man to come help me pack my bags and move out. The federal law works, and we need to push these protections that Representative Winkler mentioned into these other contracts so that soldiers and sailors don't need to worry about what's going on at home, so they can focus on their mission and be able to do and serve for all of us. And that's all I have to say on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. Colonel Allness. Thank you for coming in today. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. Colonel Eric Allness, Department of Military Affairs. Specifically, as Representative Winkler indicated, we provide tiered support to families of deployed service members of the National Guard and all other services within Minnesota, starting out with Family Programs Office, headquartered out of Cottage Grove, Minnesota. And then we have 11 family assistance centers spread through geographically throughout the state to provide regional support to the local families and the units throughout the state. And then we also have family readiness groups, volunteer-led effort in each of the communities and each of the units that are out there to help provide assistance to each other and the families. Just a couple general comments from an agency perspective on this bill. As Representative Winkler indicated, the Service Member Civil Relief Act provides some very good relief for more of the traditional type of things that families and service members face, such as loans and mortgages and credit cards, but it does not go on to address things such as cell phone contracts and health club memberships and rental agreements. And that's typically what you find with some of our more junior members. As indicated, those are the kind of obligations that they have, and this bill would, from our reading, provide support to that, support for those obligations. Also, I want to make sure to point out the importance that he put in there about the addressing and the spouse aspect. As we look at members as they deploy, there's a large minority of service members when they deploy, they have less income than they have in their current civilian job or what they're making at the time. Or maybe the spouse has to stop working her job so she can stay at home with the other family members. As a result, giving the opportunity so the spouse can cancel some of those obligations, some of those agreements, provides greater flexibility for the family to address their needs and make sure they can continue successfully. Additionally, some families relocate to be closer to parents, and such they can access some of those services they have. And finally, I would add, as I read through Section 3 of the bill, just consider the 2,600 service members who were recently extended in Iraq for an additional up to 125 days or 4 months. They will be getting new orders here shortly saying that they're being extended. Now, many of those, they were planning to continue their life once they redeployed, and they're making plans for weddings and different types of obligations that they could do to continue their life. Well, now they're trying to get out of those rental agreements for the wedding hall or the different locations that they're planning. My understanding on the read of that this would provide, since they're now getting new orders, the ability to get out. Now, most of the providers, most of the people who are offering these venues, they're being good Minnesotans, and they're allowing the families to exit from those type of contracts. But this kind of bill will formalize that and help those people remove so they can rebook and continue their lives after they return at a later time. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments.
Mr. Chair, four questions. I'd also like to point out that a lot of these cell phone companies, wireless providers, already have a policy that allows service members to do this. Specifically, I know that Quest, for example, does this, and all you need to do is call in and let them know. And so this bill is not designed to penalize or to replace process that's already in place for some of these companies providing the service. But the idea really is to remove obstacles that service members may face in addressing some of these challenges and to make sure they know up front what exact rights they have in this regard so they can be part of their planning and doesn't require them to sit and make phone calls to service providers as they're getting ready to go overseas rather than spending time with their family and loved ones.
Any questions from members for Representative Winkler or the testifiers? Representative House.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question. I like the bill. It's great, but
Starting with page 2, line 32, when effective, and you give two reasons. Termination of the wireless service contract is not effective until both of the following occur. Well, then you go next over to page 3, and the second item on line 3, here's where I'm confused. If the service member or the service member's spouse owns the wireless telephone, the wireless telephone is returned to the custody or control of the wireless carrier. Is the language right there? Is it if they own it, they can keep it, not if they own it, they mail it back?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, I actually had that same question. Then I reread the language again, and as I read through the commas, it says if, and the if clauses are if they own the phone, if the phone is returned to the custody or control of the wireless company carrier, or if the service member spouse agrees in writing to return it. So either of those three things would be enough to satisfy the requirement.
Other questions for Representative Winkler or the testifiers? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Nelson, thank you.
Just a comment. I do support this. It's a good bill. My international union does this with our membership when they get their orders, that we put their membership in abeyance. They don't have to pay dues, and it's automatically done. And then when they come back, they've got 90 days to pick it back up, and this is a good thing. I think we should go forward with this and support our troops as they go, as we're sending them to harm's way.
With that, Representative Benson renews his motion that House File 532 is amended, be recommended to pass, and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you.